Hello there. Today is Monday, July 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Britain weighs its options after Iran's Revolutionary Guard seizes one of its ships in the Strait of Hormuz.
The Europeans, and the British for that matter, still believe that the origins of the escalating tensions go back to the unjustified withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal by the Trump administration.
Protesters pack the streets of Hong Kong for another weekend of mass demonstrations. Also ahead, would you pay $1,000 for a pair of sneakers? It's all on today's International Edition. Hong Kong riot police fired tear gas and rubber bullets late Sunday to disperse pro-democracy protesters who again filled the streets of the Chinese territory. Tens of thousands of demonstrators protested for the seventh straight weekend, with some defacing the Chinese national emblem of Beijing's liaison office. The protests have morphed from a call for an end to the now suspended bill to extradite Hong Kong residents charged with criminal offenses to China for trial into demonstrations for democratic reforms and an end to Beijing's tighter grip on the territory. It's the worst social turmoil to rock the former British colony since it returned to Chinese rule 22 years ago. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Andrew Scobell, senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation. He asked him how long these protests could go on.
Well, I guess there are three sides. The protesters, the Hong Kong authorities, and then Beijing, the national authorities in the capital, Beijing. And none of those three parties seem amenable to compromise or de-escalation. And so how long can this go on? It could go on for more weeks, but with the events that took place this Sunday, if that kind of thing continues, it's probably going to force the hand of the authorities.
Why do you think it has gone on so long, and why do you think that the scope of the protest has expanded as it has?
One of the reasons why the protests have gone on so long, I think, is because the protesters are made up of a variety of groups that have different priorities, different demands, and it's hard to get unity and cohesion. So that means that individual groups can organize protests, and then they can snowball. So it's very hard for any individual or group to organize or coordinate the protests, which makes it much more volatile, much more difficult to control. The other important reason why the protests have not slowed down or ended is because there hasn't been a acceptable or response from the authorities, whether that's the local authorities in Hong Kong or from Beijing. Of course, the one important meeting of the protesters' demands was the pulling of the extradition law, which was significant. Beyond that, there hasn't really been a clear response, and so it's both frustrated and emboldened the protesters.
What do the protesters really want? What could end these protests?
There are a variety of demands, which makes it hard for them all to be met, and very unlikely that they'll all be met. So whether some concessions on one or more of these by the Hong Kong authorities would make a difference, it's really hard to say. And to be fair Chief Executive Carrie Lam and the Hong Kong authorities, they're really in a very difficult situation because they're under pressure, obviously, from the protesters, but they're also under pressure from Beijing to get, you know, restore order, restore stability in Hong Kong. And responding to those different pressures, I wouldn't wish on anyone.
Is everything being synchronized in these protests by social media? Is everything, or is there some kind of outside, the possibility of some kind of outside force that is taking hold of at least part of these protests?
To the best of my knowledge, these are very self-directed and driven from by Hong Kong, different groups within Hong Kong. What is also important is the perception in Beijing that there are outside forces exerting influence or manipulating or inciting these things and these events, and that makes for a great deal of paranoia and alarm if on the part of Chinese leaders, which does not augur well, I think, for the future of Hong Kong.
Andrew Scobell, and a senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation, speaking to VOA Asia's Ira Melman. A British warship warned an Iranian patrol boat against interfering with the passage of the Stena Impero oil tanker through the Strait of Hormuz, according to a new recording released Sunday. But Iran Revolutionary Guard commandos descending from a helicopter seized it shortly after. In the audio released by the maritime security risk firm Dryad Global, a British naval officer can be heard telling the tanker that it was operating in international waters and that its passage must not be impaired, intruded, obstructed, or hampered. But an Iranian officer told the tanker to change course.
A Sefa Navy patrol boat, this is British warship Foxtrot.
Charge port, sail 3. Foxtrot 236, this is Sefa Navy patrol boat. No challenge is intended. No challenge is intended. I want to inspect the ship for security reason, over.
Iran continues to hold the tanker and its crew of 23, a mix of 18 Indians, 3 Russians, a Latvian, and a Filipino, but said they are in good health. Britain has called the seizure a hostile act. Joining us to talk more about it is Ramesh Thakur, Emeritus Professor at the Australian National University. Why do you think the Iranians took this action?
This is a clear tit-for-tat for the British seizing an Iranian tanker off the coast of Gibraltar a week or so ago. It ties into a very confusing situation, starting with the fact that this week the UK will have a new prime minister, and one of the contenders, of course, is the foreign minister or the foreign secretary, Jeremy Hunt. When the British seized the Iranian tanker, it was under suspicions that it was ferrying oil to Syria, which is under EU sanctions. But curiously, the Europeans were not actually happy with the British decision, because for practical purposes, they seem to have come to a realistic conclusion that Assad is going to survive this crisis, so let's just de-escalate that. But Britain sees that Iran made certain threats and has carried out its threats of retaliation effectively. The legalities will be contested. I think the legality of the British seizure originally is open to contestation. I think the Iranian action is much more clearly illegal. So that's where that goes to. On this issue, the British do have European solidarity, but then it ties into the larger question of the Europeans, and the British for that matter, still believe that the origins of the escalating tensions go back to the unjustified withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal by the Trump administration, and the fear that the American Secretary of State and National Security Advisor Mike Pompeo and John Bolton are trying to box President Trump in to increasingly military options. You know, there are very few good options left for the Brits. They don't seem to have the naval capability to protect all the British flagged ships using that waterway. This will probably produce a spike in oil prices. It will certainly increase the premiums for ships going through the Strait of Hormuz. And it raises the prospect of a military conflict. It opens up the question for Britain. Do they want to support a naval task force led by the United States to patrol the Gulf or the Strait? If so, they will become hostage to decisions made in Washington. So that's an unpalatable prospect as well. The differences over the Iran deal between Europe and Britain on the one side and the United States on the other remain. But of course, we know that the most likely next Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, is much more firmly pro-US and anti-EU than has been the case so far. So it's a number of different variables playing out, but the root of that does go back to the very unwise decision by the United States to pull out of a deal that was actually delivering on its promise.
And you're saying unwise, as President Trump this weekend basically said that he's been proven right by using the example of all the things that Iran has done recently.
If the original deal was a complete sham, then there's no reason for any of us to be upset by Iran violating the terms of the deal. The very fact that we are protesting about Iranian breaches on the quantity and purity of the enrichment, which is what they have done so far and promise to go further if things are not resolved, that very fact proves that there was substantial concrete benefit in the old deal. And I think the sensible course would be to try and find some face-saving thing for President Trump to be able to say, okay, I can now declare victory and we can go back to the deal, because it did stop Iran. And then you can address, through diplomatic coalitions, the other unhappiness that we have with Iran with regard to their missiles, with regard to their fomenting instability in the Middle East. But the nuclear file was important, critical. It was working. We had a good agreement. We need to get back to that as the most prudent means of de-escalating tensions. And interestingly, I think the British even now are actually urging Washington to de-escalate rather than to make further inflammatory statements. So the consensus seems to remain that the key to de-escalation is Washington rather than Iran.
Do you think that Israel has a big role in why the Trump administration is so concerned with Iranian nukes but not North Korean?
Absolutely. I think Iran is a big factor, and that's legitimate. I mean, Iran is an existential threat. But even from their point of view, countries' leaders are capable of making mistakes regarding their own country. And I think Israel has been foolish in its obsession with Iran. I think that was justified under the previous leader, Ahmadinejad, who made some incendiary statements about Israel being wiped off the map. I think the new leader has not been that irresponsible. I think containing Iran's possible nuclear weapon ambitions is in Israel's interest. That is what the deal was doing. And while the deal was in force and working, that's the time to pursue diplomatic solutions to other problems we have with Iran. This way, it's just lighting a fuse to a very volatile situation.
That's Ramesh Thakur, Emeritus Professor at the Australian National University. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Former Special Counsel Mueller will give substantial evidence for impeaching Trump, according to a top Democrat. Ukraine exit poll finds 43.9% voted for the president's party. Relief is in sight for a U.S. heat wave that's killed six people. And ISIS is decentralizing into provinces in a bid to return. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Trump has renewed his Twitter attack on four Democratic congresswomen. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
Quoting the president on Twitter, "I don't believe the four congresswomen are capable of loving our country." And to echo that, Trump campaign advisor Mercedes Schlapp on ABC's This Week.
These Democratic presidential candidates are going to have to kiss the ring of the squad because they are the new voices of the Democrat Party, and that should be concerning.
But Democratic Congressman Elijah Cummings isn't worried.
These are folks and women who love their country, and they work very hard, and they want to move us towards that more perfect union that our founding fathers talked about.
Cummings also spoke on ABC's This Week. Shelley Adler, Washington.
Education has been a key issue for Democratic candidates running for president in the 2020 race, especially as they seek the support of younger Americans who've now replaced baby boomers as the country's largest voting bloc. But education is not the only concern for these young voters. Other social issues are likely to motivate them to go to the polls in 2020. Zahar Majid has more on this report for VOA, narrated by Kathleen Strzok.
For Samantha McAllister, a third-year student at the American University in Washington, D.C., high tuition fees and student debt are major concerns defining her generation.
The cost of universities has gotten very difficult for students, even on the community college and state college level. And certainly private universities like the one I attend, it's getting pretty crazy, and we're not even one of the most expensive schools in the country.
Sonsia Coleman of the advocate group Young Invincibles agrees.
I think higher education and student debt is a big issue, and it's impacting young adults, their ability to either attend school, and on the older end of millennials, their ability to buy homes and, you know, their decisions whether or not to have children. It's really impacting their lives and their economic opportunities, so that's a big issue.
Democratic presidential candidates are offering various education proposals to attract younger voters, but some are more realistic than others, say experts.
I think the least likely of the plans is loan forgiveness, especially a broad-based loan forgiveness program is not very likely. It would be very expensive and would not really be good policy either. So I think that's the least likely policy. Free college, some version of free college is very likely to occur, probably one of the less expensive versions, either free community college or debt-free college.
Aside from education, younger voters are also concerned by a handful of social issues.
Also health care. We made big strides with the ACA in terms of lowering the uninsured rate among young adults. But I think there's a moral imperative there from some of the young people we talk to. They really want to see universal coverage, but they also, it's an economic opportunity issue for young adults, some of whom because of just stagnating wages and things like that.
Some of those social issues are exclusive to their generation because they didn't exist for their elders.
Civic engagement, just wanting folks to have access to the ballot box, as well as immigration. That's a key issue that continues to be a big issue for young adults and dreamers.
Harvard University's Institute of Politics released a youth poll in the spring that showed elder statesmen Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders had the most support among young voters. But since then, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts and South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg have risen in popularity. While there might be more young voters than older voters in 2020, traditionally the younger voters do not turn out in full force on Election Day. But that's slowly changing, and presidential contenders are having to adjust their campaign proposals to attract the youth vote. Kathleen Strzok for Sahar Majid, VOA News, Washington.
The United Nations says Zimbabwe's food situation is moving from a crisis to an emergency. A majority of the population is food insecure because of El Nino-induced drought and the ongoing economic meltdown. Columbus Mavunga has the story from a poor township just outside the capital of Harare.
Placidus Ubura lives in the impoverished town of Epworth, less than an hour drive southeast of Harare. It's just one of the towns in Zimbabwe that's in desperate need of food aid. The 48-year-old unemployed woman says she's having trouble feeding her grandchildren.
We have resorted to just one meal a day. At times, it's just the vegetables we get in our garden. We are struggling to get money to buy food. I wish donors would bring us food, especially for the children, as I'm not employed. Even school fees I can't pay. One of them was not well, so medical bills. They go to school without eating, as we do not have any food.
UN aid agencies and the government say Zimbabwe needs about $218 million to stave off hunger for about 5.5 million people between now and April 2020. That's when the next harvest is expected, and thus assuming there will be enough rains. The United Nations is currently urging farmers to invest in irrigation or small grains to make the country more food secure. The ongoing drought has devastated crops, especially corn, which is used to make the staple food sadza, a thick porridge that is served with relish. In addition, Cyclone Idai in March destroyed many crops a few weeks before harvest time.
Unfortunately, we're moving from crisis to emergency, which is pretty serious. Also, the economic challenges facing the country. People have lost their income. The situation is really precarious. Are hoping on the generosity of the international community, the dependence on international community would be much more.
He says the U.S., the United Kingdom, and the European Union have been generous on food aid in the past and hopes they will come through again. Unfortunately, that generosity might not do much to ensure Harare and other cities have enough safe drinking water. The city of Harare says two of its reservoirs have dried up and others are following suit. Water rationing has begun. The poor economy has also led to a shortage of water treatment chemicals, raising fears of waterborne diseases like cholera. That would only add miseries to the likes of Placidus Shimura, who at the moment is mainly concerned about providing food to her family. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA News Feeds. VOAnews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, if there's any doubt that the 2019 box office belongs to the Walt Disney Company, this weekend put an end to that with two Disney films setting records, including the blockbuster debut of The Lion King. Here's Ben Thomas.
Everything the light touches is our kingdom.
And with The Lion King booked into more than 4,700 North American theaters, that kingdom certainly includes the box office. In the remake, the anthropomorphic animals look real, even if much of their behavior is all Hollywood. The Lion King scored the ninth biggest opening of all time, hauling in $185 million domestically, a record for a PG-rated film.
We're in the endgame now.
And speaking of records, Avengers Endgame from Disney's Marvel Studios.
We still have one promise to keep.
Officially passed Avatar this weekend as the biggest film of all time, with worldwide earnings totaling $2.79 billion. I'm Ben Thomas.
A very high-end clothing designer is making sneakers inspired by a glittering green dress worn by actress and singer Jennifer Lopez at the Grammy Awards 19 years ago. The limited edition Chain Reaction is a platform sneaker that looks a lot like the pattern of the green jungle print on the dress Lopez wore. She wore it on that Grammy night, and it's said to have propelled her reputation for being a fashion icon. The sneaker will be available for men and women in stores in Boston and New York, but it will not come cheap. Price tag will be around $1,000 for one pair. I can be your medicine, yeah. Think you need some medicine, give you a taste of what you give out. Think you need some medicine. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. And thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Oh, I could be alive.
uptown, baby. Shorty, you haven't sent, get my medicine. Moving on up, George Jefferson. South Bronx, where it happened. On the yacht, catching fish, we don't get catfish. Medicine, magic, horse and carriage. Sicker than your average, ladies be the baddest. I know it, see the drip. I am Montega, a.k.a. Young Whip. I whip, saucy poop, drip drop. Top, top of the roof, flip flops.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Forward. Forward. 48 down, 2.5. Picking up some dust.
Today marks one of the pinnacles of human achievement. 50 years ago, Apollo 11 astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Collins were the first humans to land on the surface of the moon.
Okay, engine stop. Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
A little more than 6 hours after touchdown, Neil Armstrong stepped from the lunar lander and onto the moon's surface. His footprint remains in the dust there to this day.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The flight of Apollo 11 was met with a jubilant reaction around the globe. Everyone shared in the success of the astronauts. The front pages of newspapers the world over reflected the strong enthusiasm. Police reports noted that streets in many cities were eerily quiet during the moonwalk as residents watched television coverage in homes, bars, and other public places. For one priceless moment in the whole history of man, all the people on this earth are truly one. Then-President Richard Nixon radioed the moonwalkers from the Oval Office. One in their pride in what you have done, and one in our prayers that you will return safely to Earth. Over the next 3.5 years, 5 more missions would achieve a lunar landing, and 10 more astronauts would walk on the moon. But none came close to capturing the world's imagination as did that first landing on July 20, 1969. In the words of Glenn Lunny, the flight director on duty for Apollo 11's climb back to lunar orbit, "For all the millennia that humans have walked on this planet and looked up at the moon and looked up at the stars, this was the first time when two of us walked and worked and lived on another planet. And in the big sweep of history yet to come, we may look back on this not as a technological achievement. We may end up looking back and seeing that it was the beginning of a new stage for mankind as we know it."
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
This is VOA News.